This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Indonesian citizens make up 40% of our foreign worker population, numbering an estimated 1.6 million documented migrants. However, the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted the movement of labour between our two countries, which has yet to resume to the level seen prior to 2020, despite the reopening of borders. What's preventing Indonesian workers from returning to Malaysia? Joining me to discuss this issue and more is His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. Pak Hermono, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you, Sazana, for having me.
Malaysia and Indonesia signed an MOU for recruitment and protection of Indonesian domestic workers in April. But 3 months later, Indonesia froze the hiring process for all foreign workers to Malaysia over violations to the agreement. So have these violations been addressed to your satisfaction at present?
Yes, we already agreed with the government of Malaysia to fully respect and implement the MOU. Now we are sending our migrant workers, both domestic and non-domestic workers, to Malaysia. But the flow of our workers to Malaysia is very, very slow, not as high as we expect. And I believe there are some reasons why this flow of Indonesian migrant workers to Malaysia become very slow. In case of domestic worker, I think around less than 1,000 coming to Malaysia. We already approved a huge number of requests for migrant workers to Malaysia, both domestic and non-domestic workers. But the flow of our workers to Malaysia is very, very slow. So I think that's what the reason why Malaysia is still facing a serious shortage of migrant workers, because the inflow of our workers to Malaysia is not as high as expected.
Apologies there for the slightly muffled audio. That should be corrected now. Ambassador, you mentioned that the flow of workers to Malaysia hasn't been as large as anticipated and that there are several reasons for that. What are these reasons?
First, those who have returned to Indonesia, most of them are considered as undocumented workers. So during recalibration, a large number of Indonesian workers returned to Indonesia. And these workers cannot enter Malaysia again because they are on a blacklist. That's one reason. Second reason, now more countries are also open for Indonesian migrant workers. We just signed MOU with Saudi Arabia, and then I think it's another option. The third reason, we see that more and more Indonesians prefer to work in Indonesia rather than going to other countries because they want to be close with their family, or maybe they have they had a bad experience working in foreign countries. So I guess this is the reason why not many Indonesians are really willing to work in foreign countries, including in Malaysia. They have more choices of opportunity.
Different factors coming into play in the
yes.
choices that the workers are making.
Yes.
I want to focus a little bit on this MOU for the recruitment of domestic workers. One of the things I've been wondering is why there is a specific agreement for the recruitment of domestic workers in particular. Does this apply to just Malaysia, or does it apply to domestic workers in any country that Indonesia sends workers
to? This MOU is specifically designed for Malaysia. Because the condition, the background are totally different.
I see.
We have better protection for those who are working in Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and so on. But this MOU is become a model of our MOU just recently signed with Saudi Arabia, because we have similar background problem. The number of abuse higher compared to our domestic worker in other countries.
And why do you think that's the case, Ambassador, why is it that the abuse cases are so high in countries like Malaysia and Saudi Arabia compared to Singapore and Taiwan, as you mentioned? Is that due to the domestic legislation in existence?
Yes, that's one thing. The second thing, I guess, because of the law enforcement. In Singapore, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, law enforcement to those employers who abuse their domestic workers really, really tough. So they are really afraid to abuse their domestic workers. But I believe in what I found here in Malaysia is a bit difficult to, you know, to really enforce those who are abusing our domestic workers, those who hire undocumented, those who unpaid the salary for years and without any punishment from the law enforcement agency. Mm. But I think another factor is about the perception of the employers. They are employers who perceive that their domestic workers, like, you know, like a slave, you are free not to pay as long as you give them food or accommodation. That's enough for Indonesian, because Indonesian are maybe poor. So this kind of perception happened, you guys, because I found that many employer, when we ask them to pay their salary, we give them food already, we give them accommodation, why should I pay? Mm. This kind of perception, I think, need to be changed also. Mm-hmm. And it may change when the law enforcement agency really takes a tough measure to those abusing their workers.
Do you have any theories on why law enforcement is lax in this issue? Mm. Is this down to a lack of resources on the law enforcement part, or are there other factors maybe influencing what they do in these kinds of cases?
I'm not so sure. Yeah, I'm not so sure about problem of law enforcement. I think not only in case of migrant workers, maybe in other sectors. I think you, Malaysian, you know better than me how the law enforcement in this country works. But I believe Malaysia need to take tougher measure to those who abuse the migrant workers, because it will affect also the image of Malaysia internationally. You know that Malaysia for the two consecutive years now under Tier 3. So there's a strong message, a clear message that need to be fixed here in Malaysia.
And you are, of course, referring to the U.S. Trafficking in Persons list. I want to come back to this MOU, Ambassador. This particular MOU actually expired in 2016.
Yes.
Why did it take so long, 6 years, for this agreement to be renewed?
Actually, we were willing to conclude the MOU as soon as possible, because according to Indonesian law, if Indonesia doesn't have MOU with country like Malaysia, we cannot send our domestic workers. I myself see that for Malaysia, it will be better without MOU.
Without
MOU. No obligation, it's more free to do. So. But for us, we need the MOU because we need to protect our workers. Mm. So there's an asymmetric interest between the two. When I came here on October 2020 from Madrid, I was tasked by my government, you have to conclude the MOU. Mm. And then I talked to Malaysian government, and okay, fine, if you don't want to have MOU, we don't want to send our workers to Malaysia. Mm. And that time, and the Malaysia, okay, let's have an MOU. And only 4 months of negotiation, we can conclude the MOU. So it's quite fast compared to our MOU with other countries. Mm. But it happened only when we stopped sending workers to Malaysia. Mm.
I do want to find out your experience in the negotiations, because not too long after the agreement was signed and then the agreement was suspended, we did hear the Home Affairs Minister, Datuk Sri Hamzah Zainuddin, saying that the suspension stemmed from a misunderstanding. Is this how you would characterize what happened? And maybe you could elaborate on where this misunderstanding occurred. Was it between Indonesia and Malaysia, or was it within Malaysian agencies themselves that didn't understand what was going on?
Indonesian fully understand what we sign. And I believe Ministry of Human Resources also understand what the minister signed. The problem is, maybe you follow my statement in number of media. We ask the Ministry of Home Affairs also should be part of the negotiating team. And so far, only twice, and a very low level of representative from Home Ministry in the negotiation process. So that's why when we signed the MOU, maybe the Ministry of Home Affairs did not fully aware what the MOU all about. So it's not misunderstanding. We don't have any misunderstanding. We fully understand. But I think this is within the Ministry of Home Affairs and the Ministry of Human Resources. But maybe because from my side, we don't have any issue of misunderstanding. And on my position, once we sign the MOU, means that the two sides fully understand, fully agree what they are signing.
And for an issue as complex as migration, labor, and human trafficking, you have to acknowledge, Ambassador, that the perpetrators are never just on one side of the border. It comprises a complex web on both sides, sure, in multiple countries that take advantage of the economically desperate and vulnerable. Yes. So what is Indonesia doing to tackle syndicates or agencies that are dishonest in recruiting workers for overseas jobs?
Yeah, first, you are right that this is a problem of Indonesia. Because I always say to my government, Ministry of Law and Human Rights, who oversee the migration issues, the Ministry of Manpower, we failed to prevent the undocumented flow of migrant workers. And exactly as I said to you, I was asked by the parliament to meet to discuss these trafficking issues. Because most of the trafficking issues from Indonesia to Malaysia, either the Malaysia as final destination or Malaysia as a transit point. So I will brief the parliament and other ministries in Jakarta what happened and what we need to do. So yes, we do have problem. We are very weak in preventing the flow of undocumented workers, not only to Malaysia, but also to other countries. But Malaysia has been used as a transit point of our workers going to Middle East, going to Cambodia recently. So there's a complex issues. And we already proposed a kind MOU between Indonesia and Malaysia on trafficking in person.
Okay, so this is a problem that you acknowledge on your end, and you're working on it with Malaysian authorities. Hopefully, we'll see something come up in the future. I'm speaking to His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. When we come back, we'll discuss plans for Nusantara, Indonesia's new capital city in East Kalimantan. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and with me today is His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. Now, Pak Hermono, this isn't your first rodeo in Malaysia. You were stationed here as the Deputy Chief of Mission from 2013 to 2015, and now you're back as the Head of Mission. What have been your priorities in strengthening bilateral ties between our two countries?
Yeah, first, my task is addressing the migrant issues. Okay, now I'm trying to finish this and I think I'm on the right track. And secondly, economic relation. And Indonesia export to Malaysia, Malaysia is the eighth largest export destination. And our export to Malaysia last year achieved the highest since the last 10 years. So even during COVID, our export to Malaysia increased significantly. And investment also, we are trying to attract more Malaysian investors to Indonesia, especially in information technology and infrastructure. I know Malaysia is very strong in information technology and infrastructure, and we need Malaysian expertise and also investment.
I do want to touch on this issue of the post of Malaysian ambassador to Indonesia. This has remained vacant for over a year now. Uh-huh. And back in July this year, there were rumors that one of our members of parliament, Tajuddin Abdurrahman, was slated to take up this role, which generated a lot of controversy. I guess, how much say does the Indonesian government have over chosen envoys to Jakarta?
No. We have nothing to say. It's 100% up to Malaysia. Even when Dato' Sri Tajuddin was named as Malaysian ambassador to Jakarta, we knew that a lot of controversy here, a lot of comment. But in fact, we already gave the agreement to Dato' Sri Tajuddin. We don't have any objection.
Okay, there was no intervention from
intervention.
The government.
We fully respect the appointment of any person to be Malaysian ambassador to Jakarta, to Indonesia. But of course, we want to have the best Malaysian citizen to serve the interests of Malaysia. That's what we are hoping. We hope that Malaysian ambassador in Jakarta will be filled soon. It's too long, because if you keep the embassy vacant for such a long time, sends a wrong message, a negative message to Jakarta. But I already convinced to Jakarta, no, this is not the case. Malaysia is appointing a new ambassador. I was told that the new candidate already there. But of course, we hope that Malaysia will have a new ambassador as soon as possible, because a lot of issues that we need to talk with Malaysia. And next year, we are going to be the chair of ASEAN, and also, of course, a lot of activities there.
Are you able to share any hints on who this potential candidate may be?
What I heard is a career diplomat.
Okay.
What I heard.
All right. We'll be keeping an eye out for those announcements as well. I do want to focus on the move of the capital city to East Kalimantan. Indonesia has unveiled the name as Nusantara. Mm-hmm. I understand that this is a project that's going to be decades in the making. Mm. What is the timeline, do you think, of when Nusantara will come online and start to be operational?
The construction already started, and the first phase of construction will be 2024. The presidential palace, the parliament building, the main office will be moved to the new capital in 2024. And the president said that he want to celebrate Indonesian Independence Day, August 2024, in the new capital. The development of new the new capital will be divided into four phases, and it will be concluded in 20 or 25 years. So now just start the new building, the new construction in the nucleus, the central part of the new capital.
That's a pretty accelerated timeline when you think about it. Less than 2 years from now, you're planning to move a lot of the key institutions to Nusantara. I understand that the government is pursuing to fund 80% of development through public-private partnership and investment. So what kind of investment partners is Indonesia looking for to build this mega project? Are there specific countries that maybe you're targeting to partner with in this endeavor?
Actually, we are aiming Malaysia as the neighbors. Our neighbor, the closest neighbor, will be one of our investor in this new capital. And I'm going to organize a kind of promotion, the opportunity in the new capital, scheduled on the 6th of October. So I will bring the official from the new capital authority to explain this is the opportunity. But basically what we need is huge, because this is, we built from the scratch. So we need construction, we need energy, we need waters, we need sewage management. So we need everything there.
Okay.
So this is a huge opportunity, and I hope that Malaysia, as the closest neighbor will also be there to participate in building the new capital. And I know, I believe Malaysia has the expertise to do so. You have experience building new Putrajaya, the new outset, not really capital, but the new government area in Putrajaya. So your expertise in building Putrajaya can be shared to our new capital.
And turning our attention to Indonesia's economy, and I guess linking this also to the development of Nusantara, which, as you said, is going to be done in 2 years, the speed of this development is going to depend on the robustness of the Indonesian economy. And the economy has held up remarkably well so far, but the high cost of crude oil has meant that Indonesia's national budget has come under pressure, and the government made the decision to reduce oil subsidies this month. I'm wondering whether this policy can withstand the backlash from the population in Indonesia, because a 30% hike in oil prices, that's a tough pill for anybody to swallow.
Indonesia is a democratic country. Of course, people are free to demonstrate if they think that the government not helping them to provide the cheap oil price. I believe it will the people at the end of the day will understand why the government take this very difficult decision, because our budget is under pressure. If we have to give a subsidy too big to the oil price. On the other side, we need also the budget to develop others, education, new capital, infrastructure, and so on. We cannot just burn the money for oil. And yes, our economies have been doing very well. Even now, we are projecting that this year will be 5.2 or 5.3% growth in GDP. And what we are worried is what happened next year. The war between Russia and Ukraine will have a very bad effect to the world economy. And our economy, finance minister Sri Mulyani also warned the people, look, next year will be very, very hard. We have to be careful in managing the economy, because many countries will enter into a recession. Of course, Indonesia, according to Bloomberg, is only 3% opportunity to enter a recession.
For now.
It's quite good compared to other countries. Look at what happened in Europe.
So taking the tough decision when things are still good rather than wait when things get worse and then making that difficult decision.
That's right.
I do want to focus on your commodity policy. You know, President Joko Widodo garnered a lot of attention when he met with Tesla CEO Elon Musk in May. And this ties in with policy efforts to transform the Indonesian mining sector.
Yes.
How the government has done this, though, for nickel at least, is by imposing export bans on nickel and, in a sense, forcing investors to set up base in Indonesia. How would you respond to criticisms that such commodity export bans are not competitive and could ultimately backfire on Indonesia?
The statistics show that the export of commodity after being processed in Indonesia is much, much higher, rather than sending the raw material to other countries. That's what President Jokowi wants. All raw material process should be processed in Indonesia. And after nickel, bauxite will follow.
Yeah. This is a deliberate strategy on the government.
Deliberate strategy, not only nickel. Start from nickel, then bauxite, aluminium, and others. You know that also the Freeport, you have to build smelter in Indonesia or we end the contract. And then Freeport agreed to build smelter in Indonesia. After, since 67, always send the raw material to other countries and process in other countries. We don't know what is inside this. So I think that's the strategy of President Jokowi, and he will continue this strategy to other mineral as well.
How does Indonesia's mining-focused economy square with ambitions to become carbon neutral by 2060, if I'm not mistaken? Because while the rest of the world is pivoting to reduce reliance on fossil fuels and reduce carbon emissions, mining activity, that's in direct contradiction of that aim to become carbon neutral.
Indonesia is gradually passing out the use of coal as a source of energy. Now we are also moving to green and clean energy. But of course, it's not easy. is very expensive, especially when the price of oil, gas and oil now very expensive. But the commitment is there. Our commitment by 2030, the reduce the carbon dioxide by 29% by ourselves, or 40% with the cooperation with international community. Mm. So the commitment to produce clean and green energy is there. We are moving, and the new capital, Nusantara, the clean and green capital. So,
but it will require a lot of carbon emissions first before we get to the capital that's green.
No. The number of trees that will be cut is not that big.
We'll hold you to that, Ambassador. Yeah. I'm speaking to His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. We'll come back after the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin in an extended discussion on the Breakfast Grill to focus on Indonesia's role at the international stage. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Welcome back to an extended conversation on the Breakfast Grill with His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. Now, Ambassador, world leaders recently convened in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, but President Jokowi was noticeably absent from the proceedings. He's never attended the UNGA in his 8 years as president, which has raised eyebrows. Are observers right to question Indonesia's commitment to the UN and multilateral diplomacy?
No. The commitment is there. Of course, President Jokowi has a priority. Which one is more important? I think there's some domestic issues that are more important. And we know UN General Assembly is a yearly event. Of course, there's a lot of leaders. But Jokowi, President Jokowi, is the person that really wants to spend his time to a very concrete, to solve the very concrete issues for the people. So for this kind of issues is not really in his highest agenda.
But Lucy,
he visit Ukraine, he visit Russia to bridge the differences between the two countries. So it's a matter of priority.
Okay, so it appears that President Jokowi maybe looks at bilateral engagement more. He emphasizes bilateral engagement more than multilateral engagement.
Yes.
As you mentioned, President Jokowi has been one of the few leaders to maintain relations with both Ukraine and also Russia. And he met with both President Zelensky and President Putin in quick succession earlier this year. Is Indonesia looking to play a mediating role in this conflict? Is that the role that Indonesia is assuming?
Yeah, we are trying to bridge how we can end the war if there's no communication between the two conflicting parties. They need to communicate. They need someone to be a messenger between the two. Mm. That's what Jokowi want to play. That's one also the reason why during the G20 summit, we invite President Putin, and we also invite President Zelensky, just to bridge the differences, just to open the line of communication. If there is no communication, how can you find solution to this war?
But at the same time, President Putin's presence may not be welcomed by other Western G20 members. So I'm wondering, how is Indonesia navigating this geopolitical minefield when the summit is held in November?
Let's see whether they are coming or not. I believe that Foreign Minister Ratna Marsudi, President Jokowi also took to the leaders to explain the reason, the importance of inviting these two conflicting presidents. Because how can we stop the war if these two conflicting parties, they don't talk each other?
Is there any chance that Western countries won't turn up during November in a sign of protest, especially if the war escalates in Ukraine?
I cannot speculate, but I believe that President Jokowi, Minister Ratna Marsudi also talked to other leaders to convince the importance of this G20 meeting. And this is the very timely summit, G20 summit, because we have a lot of challenges. We have economic challenges. We have security challenges. So this is the forum that all leaders can say how to solve this problem. Mm. Don't miss this opportunity. So I think this is the importance of G20. This is the forum that all leaders, big leaders, can share their views.
Why the G20 and not the UN, Ambassador?
UN is, you know UN lah, yeah. You know UN is a lot. UN is important, but you know, if you listen to Minister Retno Marsudi deliver in UN General Assembly, we commit to multilateralism, but multilateralism that delivered result.
Okay, fair enough. So we'll see. All eyes will be on in Bali in November,
yes,
when the G20
yes.
convenes. I'd like to end on ASEAN and your views on how the grouping can be made more effective. As you mentioned, Jakarta, Indonesia, will be taking up the chairmanship next year. And I think we've seen over the past few years that there's been considerable disillusionment with the mechanism of ASEAN in the wake of the coup in Myanmar and ASEAN's inability to really make any headway in restoring stability in that country. Mm. Why do you think ASEAN has failed to make progress on Myanmar?
We know that ASEAN is facing internal and external pressure. The tension in the region is growing, you know. And other ASEAN countries also facing a kind of frustration when dealing to Myanmar issues because they don't want to comply with the 5-point consensus. And again, Minister Retno Marsudi also mentioned during the speech, her speech in UN, expressing her frustration. And we hope that under Indonesian chairmanship next year, we will find a solution. It's not easy. It's not easy. Dealing with the military junta is not easy compared to with civilian leaders. Mm. But ASEAN should remain solid. There's no choice.
Mm. Is there anything that Indonesia is looking to do differently when you take the chair next year?
Indonesia has a long experience in solving this kind of conflict. In Khmer before, in Vietnam also, in South China Sea also. So I believe Indonesia will find a solution in these issues because ASEAN should remain solid. I hope we will play a positive role in bridging the differences between Myanmar and the rest of ASEAN countries. We don't want to see Myanmar is being isolated by other ASEAN countries, but we have experience and being the biggest countries in within ASEAN, I hope also Myanmar will listen more to Indonesia rather than to, let's say, the previous chair, Cambodia, as the chair of ASEAN. So I hope.
Something that we'll be keeping an eye on also. Pak Hermono, we've only scratched the surface of all the issues that we could discuss, and I do hope we can continue this conversation
in
the
very near future. Thank you very much for being here once again.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sarana.
I've been speaking to His Excellency Hermono, Ambassador of Indonesia to Malaysia. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.